Tonight's topic, unlike other such subjects and foundations of religious Zionism talks that have been presented, I think has a little more difficulty to it, in as much as for many people, for many thousands of people, this subject continues to be a source of great and searing pain. And what I hope to do tonight is to speak with you a little bit about some of my thoughts and reflections, but I begin with the caveat that I am a chutznik, a Canadian citizen. Within the last year and a half, became an American citizen. I'm not a citizen of the State of Israel. That said, as a Jew and as a religious Zionist, and I'd like to believe a proud religious Zionist at that, this is a very difficult subject for me to present upon, and I'll share a little more about that in a few minutes' time, about why it particularly still I consider it to be a very painful element of where we are in the religious Zionist community. The first thing we need to recognize is that we're gathered tonight on the eve upon which the history of this great country was changed forever. It's just about 2 hours from now, Eastern time, that the President of the United States of America went on that fateful journey to Ford's Theater. It was April the 14th, 150 years ago tonight, in 1861, that the President of the United States of America... 1865, excuse me, sorry, that's what I meant to say. I'm going to come to 1861 in a minute. April 14th, 1865, the President of the United States was gunned down and was assassinated. I was thinking about 1861 because on April the 12th of 1861, that's the beginning of a blood-soaked period in the history of the United States of America. And we ought to reflect in this 150th year since the death of the President of the United States, the 16th President, and also after 150 years have elapsed since the Civil War of the United States, that the low estimate of the casualties in that war are 620,000 people who died in the Civil War, who died on the battlefield, whether from combat or starvation or accident or epidemic. There's a statistic that in all the other wars of the United States of America combined, there are somewhere in the order of 649,000 dead. One single war had nearly as many casualties. According to a historian at Binghamton University in 2011, J. David Hacker, he thinks that the war dead numbered much higher, closer to 750,000 people. And that's 20% higher than the commonly cited figure of 620,000. The traditional estimate became iconic, and it's been quoted for the last 100 years or more. But he went back and he tried to recalculate it, whatever analyses he used. But he pointed out that if his number is correct, then the number of Americans who died on that battlefield, on those battlefields, in that very painful and traumatic period, outstrips the number of Americans who have died in the line of duty in all the other wars of the United States. Consider that the American population in 1860 was about 31 million people. That's about one-tenth of the size that it is today. And if the war were fought today, that means in equivalent numbers, the number of deaths would total 6.2 million. It's a staggering number. And to consider this is to consider what a shock it was for the United States on the heels or the winding down, the denouement of the war, April 9th already, 1865, seems to be the official end. There were still skirmishes and battles that took place after that. But consider the level of pain and the pain that extended through every community. There was Ki'ein Baita Sharein Shamet. No one was left unscathed in the country. Jewish people, not only who fought and suffered casualties and losses, but Jewish communities. We have actually the record in Philadelphia. It's in today the Museum of American Jewish History in Philadelphia. There's the original copy of a prayer composed by someone named Isaac Goldstein the Levite, Isaac Goldstein Halevi. It's an acrostic prayer that he wrote in memory of President Lincoln. And it's a prayer talking about how exalted Lincoln is, who is like you. You were respected among kings and priests. May malachim v'sarim me'od niseita, etc. You did a lot. Rabot pa'ala b'nefesh nimucha. Hach li'achid b'eretz damita. Mi b'roznim Lincoln umi yitalel b'maka. Who's going to be, kamocha, excuse me, who's going to be on your level? There's no one like you. You hear the resonance, it was right after Pesach, so you hear the resonance from the Shirat Hayam. So exalted was this president of the United States, and so traumatic and searingly traumatic was the Civil War, and remains so until today. Avichad bra'anu amarta, you're the one who told us that one father created us. Lincoln came to represent and still represents so much for the American people. And I raised the specter of Abraham Lincoln, and particularly now, as 150th anniversary of his assassination. Because for all of the pain, and tonight we will discuss much pain that remains until today unrequited and unresolved, the fact that this story, whose last chapter has not yet been written, does not include a chapter of civil war is instructive and crucial, and to me, incredibly hopeful. Tension, sometimes high tension, and at certain points it seemed as if things were on the verge of coming undone, certainly in 2005, but it did not descend to the point of one brother lifting sword against another. And tonight, I don't want to speak much about the political element, about my views or uneducated views, really. I'm not a political scientist on the subject of the Hitnatkut or of the withdrawal from Yamit. I aim merely to state the facts of what has occurred and then to try to parse some of the ideas that we should perhaps consider or think about as Jews who live in the diaspora, as Jews who I've noticed through and through in this beautiful community throughout Chicago, does not really have a family without a connection to Medinat Yisrael, to the people who live there, to say nothing of members of our own community who have moved there. Beyond Yamit and Gush Katif, these were two, for those who are totally uninitiated, I don't know how anyone could be, but let's say people are, someone might be, both Yamit, which was a community just at the southern tip of the Gaza Strip, the northern corner of the Sinai, and Gush Katif, which refers to a block of settlements, 21 communities that were located throughout the Gaza Strip. Both of these territories were withdrawn from by the Israeli government. Both with government support and sanction did the people go to these places, were encouraged to live there, and owing to governmental decisions, again, without prejudice as to whether people might have personal feelings about those decisions. Decisions of the democratically elected governments of the State of Israel left the populations there with an order of evacuation. We should mention also that both, it should go without saying, attracted the most idealistic people who were willing to go to these places to live, and understanding that their very being, their very essence of being citizens of the State of Israel and being in those places that were obviously higher tension places was itself a great act of Mesirut Nefesh. That's before we come to the issue of evacuation and withdrawal and the like. However, two critical distinctions. First, is that each of these withdrawals occurred for different reasons, with different aims in mind, and under different circumstances, of course, as you might imagine. The second is that there is a vast difference, I believe, that separates Yamit, the withdrawal that took place in 1982, from the withdrawal from the Gush Katif communities in 2005. This not only in terms of scope, but also in terms of the longevity of how long the settlements existed in these places, and the intergenerational component of that withdrawal in 2005, and so on and so forth. And that's also a very important distinction. On one level, Yamit's trauma is that it's first, but Gush Katif's trauma is that it is most recent. and by orders of magnitude affects many, many more people, I believe, Adayom Azeh. In some cases, of course, the withdrawal from Gush Katif was a compounded trauma, in as much as those who evacuated Yamit, or were evacuated from Yamit more precisely, went to live in Gush Katif, and then were evacuated a second time. Yamit was established, just to refresh everyone's memory, in 1975. There was already a plan for it in 1970, after the Six-Day War in 67. There was already a plan that this was a strategic location that the Israeli government had identified, at that time actually a labor government. I don't know, it's instructive to know if it's labor or Likud or left or right, but it happens to have been. 1975, a community was established there. Recall, of course, that there was a peace treaty signed with Egypt in 1979. From day one, Anwar el-Sadat of Egypt was talking up how Yamit was an affront to his personal dignity and self-respect. He wanted it back. And that was one of the provisions, in fact, in the withdrawal from Sinai. It was the last place in all of the Sinai Peninsula that was evacuated. And so it happened in April of 1982. There were around 2,500 people living there at its height. Many of the people in advance, as you might imagine, agreed to take settlement packages from the Israeli government. Some people did not. There are, of course, stories of various conflicts that occurred therein. A group of people, not even clear if they're from, were from Yamit, barricading themselves, claiming they would commit suicide unless they were allowed to stay. I mean, there it was, not to minimize the situation, it certainly was a heavy time for the Jewish people. That was in 1982. It was part of an umbrella of a peace treaty. The opponents to the evacuation claimed at that time, of course hindsight is 2020, but they claimed at that time that it was a matter of days, if not maybe weeks, or maybe even months, before the Egyptian government would renege on the peace treaty. Having regained Yamit, they were now going to launch a new full-scale war. Of course, that did not happen, thank God, but that was a real concern. Again, hindsight 2020. Gush Katif, as I said before, a block of 21 Israeli settlements that were found in the Gaza Strip. There were 8,600 residents there who, owing to the cabinet's decision, 8,600 residents in the Gush Katif were taken out of their homes, were evacuated. The terminology, of course, is always instructive. The government, it was a hitnatkut, a disengagement. That's the official manner of referring to it. Of course, for the people who lived there, they used other terminology, gerush, pinui, things of that nature. Of course, each of them always laden with whatever the political slant seems to be. Obviously, Gaza, the Gaza Strip, it shouldn't be, maybe it's not obvious, but there's a long history the Jewish people have in the Gaza Strip. And in the Middle Ages, Risal of Najara, who was the rabbi in Gaza, he wrote Karibon. If you sing Karibon on Shabbat, it's written there. Mekubalim, who lived there, etc. There was a historic community living there. And the Jewish community was removed from there in the 1920s after the 29 riots. They were removed. There was land again that was purchased in the area of Kfar Darom, Kishmo Kenhu, toward the south, in the 30s. People settled there in 1946, evacuated again in 1948. And after the Six-Day War, already in 68, the plans proceeded apace to open communities up there. Yigal Alon was already presenting initiatives. By 1970, Kfar Darom was reestablished on the lands that were originally purchased by the Jewish people. Title deeds owned by Jewish people since the 40s. And so it continued. From the 30s, and so the beginning of settlement in 1970 went all the way until 2005. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, that means that multiple generations were born, grew up, and in turn spawned a new generation living in that place. In the 1980s, new communities were established, on and on. Former residents of the Sinai came, I mentioned, in the mid-80s. Economically, as is well known, or was well known back when Gush Katif existed, the combined assets are estimated at being in excess of $20 billion. Some of the main exports by Israel of some types of vegetation, flowers, particularly, of course, we all know the Gush Katif lettuce, it's famous for the chamamot, all made in that place. Of Israel's total exports abroad, is apparently 70% of the organic vegetables all came from Gush Katif, 60% of the cherry tomatoes, 60% of the germaniums that went to Europe, 95% of that bug-free lettuce and other greens all came from there. The settlements predominantly were in toward the south, some were toward the north, three of them toward the northern edge, Elay Sinai and Dugit and Nisanit were toward the north, and in the center was Netzarim, which basically functioned independently of the others. That's the baseline. That's just the history of what happened. In August of 2005 came the actual Hitnatkut. All of this began by an interview in the beginning of 2004 in February that then Prime Minister Ariel Sharon gave to Haaretz, in which he hatched this plan in public. I mean, he'd already obviously conjured it up earlier, and that was that there was no alternative but to withdraw from the Gaza Strip. The facts on the ground since the withdrawal are, of course, well known. The Palestinian Authority was voted out of power by democratic means, supervised by a former president of the United States of America, Jimmy Carter, and by democratic means, the Hamas, Yamach Shemam VeZichram, that's editorializing, but you'll forgive me, took power in January of 2006. They remain in power from that time until today. Of course, the abduction and the holding for many years of Gilad Shalit. Thank God he is back safely with his family again. Three wars, actual wars, were fought. You'll recall Oferet Yitzhakah in 2008 leading into 2009. War in 2012, Pillar of Defense, and most recently, of course, just now in 2014, the Tzok Eitan war that took place. Three wars, unrelenting rocket fire, of course, since the year 2000. That did not start with the withdrawal. It began in 2000, but in 2000, it was unrelenting in its focus on Sderot by the time you reach after the disengagement. So then, of course, we know what occurred. I remember, and now I guess I'm dipping into some of the personal component. I happen to have taken a vacation to Israel in the summer of 2005. Together, Lori and I went with then our baby, Gavriel. And it was wonderful to be in Israel. And for me, really a pretty traumatic summer. I know I was in Israel physically, but it seemed like Tisha B'Av just didn't come to an end. And I remember seeing an interview on TV where they interviewed a fellow in Ashkelon, and they asked him, you know, what do you think about the Hitnatkut? And he said, there's one thing I know for sure, we're next. So what Sderot has, we're next. And unfortunately, those were prescient words, and let the last number of years be proof to that. While Mori Virabi, Rav Yehuda Amital, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, was generally known to be more left-leaning on the subject of the Gaza disengagement, he told Yair Shelig of Haaretz that he was very unhappy with the plan because he really was concerned about the unilateral aspect. The fact that it is unilateral, he said, also adds to the pain the evacuees feel, because in this situation, they also do not understand why they have to undergo the pain. And now, again, hindsight 2020, not under the rubric of any kind of agreement, not under the rubric of any kind of understanding that there was any real hope for anything peaceful to emerge from the evacuation from Gush Katif, the Israeli government embarked on this plan, and I'll leave it to you to engage your own theories and thoughts about why. There are all sorts of ideas, and some have spun theories that others brand conspiracy theories about personal criminal issues involving high echelons of government that required a diversion, ranging to those who feel that this was meant to be an element of creating a trauma, a contrived trauma for the Jewish people in the state of Israel, so that it would prevent further withdrawals, and everything in between, from justification to utter vilification. I'm not attempting tonight, nor would I attempt actually in any forum, to deliver any kind of words that could be misconstrued as words representative of Torah when I don't carry any expertise, nor experience, nor citizenship as such. That being said, I do feel that I carry, as many of us do, the pain. And I did want to discuss that tonight a little more. to know that most of the shuls were destroyed by Palestinian mobs immediately after the evacuation is deeply painful. That Abu Abir, a member of the Popular Resistance Committee, announced that the looting and the burning of the synagogues is a great joy for us. And in 2007, it was reported, apparently, that the ruins of two large synagogues in Gush Katif, the evacuated Jewish communities in the Gaza Strip, have been transformed to a military base being used by the Palestinian groups to fire the rockets at the Israeli side, the Israeli cities, and trained for attacks against the Jewish state, so said a senior terror leader in Gaza. I'm not sure about the veracity of that claim. Of course, no one has been in there because, and this word I do use advisedly, the Gaza Strip, since 2005, is Judenrein. And Jews may not live there. They're not permitted to live there, not permitted to go in there, and to have any connection to that place. From February 2nd, 2004, when Prime Minister Sharon led off that that interview with Haaretz to withdraw, and until today, I think many of us are carrying that pain around. You may think I'm old-fashioned that I actually even have such a thing, let alone that I collect it or that I keep it. But as a child in my home in Montreal, I know my parents had, in a, wrapped in plastic, the newspaper from the day that Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And as a kid in the 80s, I remember taking this out. It was already sort of yellow, and take it out and look at it. Wow. You know, this kindled a great interest for me in space exploration. I remember there are a few newspapers like that of different world events, you know, happenings. And it gives me pause to consider that in my own lifetime, the newspapers that I've mostly put aside have largely been of other kinds of things. And that should give us pause in terms of religious Zionism and the like, which I'll come to in a few minutes. But just, you know, I collected the newspapers from Israel on that day. And at that time, Hayom Shelo Nishkach, pictures of soldiers climbing a building in one of the... in one of the settlements, and of course all sorts of pictures inside the papers of different things going on, people leaving their homes, the Musaf Shabbat or whatever it was from Yediot from that weekend, you know, Srim Ba'arba Sha'ot, they publish, you know, the small child Zahya Beiti, many very painful pictures here of families and of really of the tension and the consternation of people, you know, staring down fellow Jews who were charged with this responsibility to remove them from their homes and the like. And that's the moment of the disengagement itself. But that's even a snapshot. That's not including the great sense of Mesirut Nefesh that was and is held by so many people who lost loved ones to hold that place. In May of 2004, you know, one of the most difficult and horrific stories of them all was a family that moved to Gush Katif in 1992 from Ofakim. The husband was a principal of a school, and the wife, 34 years old, was in the car with her four daughters, Tali Hatuel, with Hila, Hadar, Roni, and Meirav. Meirav was 2, Hila was 11. They're driving. Actually, they were driving to go to a protest, a Hafganah, in a democratic society. Anybody should be allowed to be engaged in protest of a government policy with which they disagree. And as many of us know the story, they were gunned down. They were, in fact, murdered at point-blank range by monsters. Who masquerading as some kind of soldiers. They would call themselves maybe freedom fighters. But just absolutely horrific. David Hatuel, standing over the shrouded bodies of his wife and his daughters, he asked for forgiveness from his children and his wife for spending so much time away from home, lobbying against the plan to pull out from Gaza. This is a report from Haaretz from May 2nd, 2004. Quote, on Friday, said Hatuel, the girls drew me a picture and they wrote, Abba, we're proud of what you're doing for the home where we were born. You are my flowers and I will not forget you, he said, sobbing. And the Hatuel's car, which was found riddled with bullets, of course, and the carpet inside stained with blood, had a bumper sticker on it saying, uprooting the settlements, victory for terror. That's a report in Haaretz. That attack was the first attack to kill Israeli civilians in Gaza in more than a year, when that happened in May of 2004. So when you hear stories like that, and that's not the only story, that's just the one that I find most often coming to my mind And I think of it more often maybe than a healthy person should, considering I don't really know the Hatuel family personally. You realize a new dimension of what it means that we're not living in this place for 7 or 8 years. This is generations of people whose whole sense of self experienced emotionally a galut. That is what they experienced. They experienced it that way. And regardless of whether it was or wasn't a good idea, regardless of whatever other political calculi may have been at play, from the human perspective, the pain of this has not yet abated for so many people. Just to cite two examples of work that needs to be done. The work of Rav Yosef Tzvi Rimon and with Job Katif, it still exists as an organization. It won Pras Yisrael a few years ago. This is the work of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. These are people who were hardworking, who had farms and jobs, and some of them were able to piece their lives together. Others are still languishing and are in need of help. And this is a person who started this organization and continues to run it with everything else that he's doing. He's running Job Katif. A few years ago, our shul, our Torah, we're privileged to welcome the Shivat is there of Neve Dekalim. The executive director came to visit Shlomo Van Chotzker. At that time, we had Yaakov Amidror came to speak. It was before he was the national security advisor, still in the war college at that time, but still already a decorated soldier. And I had conversations with Shlomo Van Chotzker. He told me the yeshiva actually was originally called the Shivat Hezder of Yamit. They moved it to Neve Dekalim. Now they're in Ashdod, and they're trying to build. You know, they're trying to build a building in Ashdod. They actually already have broken ground. They're rebuilding and building. And you think about the resilience factor, and you consider that there is more than a little bit here that is also unbelievably hopeful about the resiliency of the Jewish people. Rabbi Yuval Shurlo, one of the religious Zionist leaders in Israel today, compiled the frequently asked questions that he got via email over the time period of the disengagement, the Hitnatkut. Honorable Rabbi Shurlo, hello, wrote one person. These days we are hearing incessant warnings saying that the disengagement and evacuation will cause a civil war. These warnings and alerts come from the West Bank circles and the rabbis. My question is, a civil war is by definition a war between brothers, and in order for it to happen, God forbid, one party must start it. If both sides are in a difficult and bitter argument on principles, a civil war will still not occur, writes the questioner, as long as no side considers this option possible because it prefers war and bloodshed rather than waiving its principles. It is now clear, writes this questioner, that the government and its bodies, the military and police, will not start a war against the settlers. How then would this be a civil war? Only if the settlers would start it. The very threat of a civil war demonstrates this option is being seriously considered, and not by marginal extremists, but by public leaders. Does the evacuation of the Gush Katif and Shomron settlers, didn't mention that today, but that's another story, those four settlements, as tragic and painful as this mistake might be, writes the questioner, justifying the rabbi's opinion, starting a civil war and spilling our brother's blood? Is this not an extremely dangerous incitement, and doesn't it give legitimacy to acts which might actually bring about the destruction of our country? These were actual questions sent to an actual rabbi, Rabbi Yuval Shurlo. There are many such questions that came about. This was in the air. Writes Rabbi Shurlo, the assumption that civil war will not break out unless one side is interested is not accurate. Sometimes it will take just one fool to light an entire forest on fire, and the danger is not in controlled circumstances, but in circumstances which might get out of control. B, as far as I know, it is incorrect that this option is being considered at all by the leadership, and I have no doubt that if there will be an actual danger, the entire leadership will withdraw rather than start a civil war. However, as stated above, I do fear the explosive atmosphere which might cause a civil war, God forbid. The demand to avoid the creation of this atmosphere should be directed both ways. First of all, to us settlers, because the government has a monopoly over power. However, one cannot ignore the heating up of the atmosphere by the government, which is impervious to its need of public legitimacy. And it is using this force with a predation which goes contrary to the appropriate spirit when facing such a difficult decision. The prime minister, writes Rabbi Shurlo, seems as if he is drunk on power. And this also puts our domestic existence into jeopardy. D, there is no justification of any kind to start a civil war, and even things which are worse than withdrawal from Gush Katif do not justify a civil war. All the best. This is compiled in a volume of the Orthodox Forum called Religious Zionism Post-Disengagement. This is a watershed event, a watershed painful event. I'm looking for some hopeful elements of it. The first hopeful element is, as Sir Arthur Conan Doyle writes in The Hound of the Baskervilles, the dog that did not bark. We're expecting that in this atmosphere of great tension, that there could have been, Rachmana Litzlan, God should save us from such a thing, a terrible disaster. And any of us who were to live in a state of delusion, to believe that the right-thinking minds on either side of this divide, at the time of the height of its tension, would have never permitted a civil war to occur, are living in a dreamland. We're speaking tonight on April the 14th, 2015, against the backdrop of a great and terrible historical event of this very night. And to know that is to understand a little bit first about that hopefulness, not just the resiliency of the people, but the fact that it did not devolve, thank God, but there are certain elements that were a little more worrisome. And this is something I think as religious Zionists we ought to consider and to think about. And this is also from Mori Virabi, Rav Yehuda Amital. The day before Tisha B'Av, recall that the actual Hitnatkut was taking place, was scheduled to take place really right before, but really didn't start until after. And because of the time period in which we live, lived then already, let alone now, you could watch the whole thing on TV, like in Shidur Chai. You could go on channel. It's all the news, all they're showing all day long is scenes of what's going on in Gaza, going from house to house, going into people's homes. Just one heart-wrenching scene after another. The day before Tisha B'Av, it was August 12, 2005. This is in the biography of Rav Amital, Be'emunato, in English, it's By Faith Alone. The day before, it was just days before the God Disengagement Plan's execution, Rav Amital delivered a discourse in the yeshiva in which he criticized the faith expressed by some opponents of the disengagement that the plan would not be carried out because God does not want it. Quote, "Anyone who lived through the Holocaust cannot speak like that," he said. "To my great chagrin, I live in the real world. In Hungary, before the Holocaust, I heard rabbis saying similar things. Since then, I don't prophesy about what God can or can't do. I try to cope with reality, not speculate on which reality God would prefer." And this is an instructive component of religious Zionism as well. And again, perhaps I'm very much influenced by my own rebbeim, stands to reason I would be. But this idea of not having a certain sense that because I am religious and I'm a Zionist, or maybe without a hyphen, but a synthesis of the two, they don't live in tension. I'm not a religious and I also am a Zionist. I'm a religious Zionist. I see the two as being together, which has so many positive dimensions, that can fall into a certain cognitive dissonance that is incredibly unhealthy. And there were such people, unfortunately. I don't blame them. I don't know if that I would have reacted any differently had I been in the situation. But some of those people were people in positions of leadership, positions of power, influential people, who were making such brash statements on behalf of the Ribono Shel Olam. It's not going to happen. We'll sing Hashem Hoshiyah Melech Yinenu V'Yom Koreinu. We'll say it's not going to happen. And if it does happen, so probably, you know, the cognitive dissonance then would set in another vein, probably, you know, fill in the blank XYZ with other kinds of, I don't even want to say, but let's say, perhaps overly certain ideas about what it means to be a religious Zionist, and whether perhaps this summer we got the lesson in the other direction. We were reminded about the idea that God doesn't work for us, and He'll do what He wants to do, and people will do what they're going to do, and whatever's going to be is going to be. We don't get to decide for our Kadosh Baruch Hu. The truth is, this cuts to the heart of some of the thinking of Rav Amital in general about the whole idea of the State of Israel. In 2005, before the Hitnatkut, some Rabbanim were actually announcing, we will no longer say the Hallel and Yom HaTzma'ut. In the case of Rav Shmuel Tal, well known, who was a prominent rabbi in Gush Katif, and moved to Yad Binyamin subsequent to the disengagement, he paskin, there's no more Hallel and Yom HaTzma'ut, it's finished. the saying of Reshit Smichat Gulatein, referring to the Torah, to the state of Israel as the dawn, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption, was already discussions about excising it from the prayers, because of course it isn't going to be if we withdraw, if there's going to be Hitnatkut, if they'll go ahead with it, if there'll be a Pinui, a Gerush, whatever language again a person wants to use. Rav Amital notes that this great certitude about how to understand Reshit Smichat Gulatenu came about because of the understanding of Maran Harav, Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, who was already, I couldn't say prophesizing, that would be, again, a wrong-headed word, but he was certainly had a certain prescience about him to have spoken and written so often that the Gemara in Sanhedrin was showing us a particular idea about Yemot HaMashiach, about a harbinger of the Messianic era. And Perek Chelik, V'Amar Rabbi Abba, Ein Lecha Keitz Megula Mizeh. There is no more revealed identifier of the end of days than this. What is this? The verses from the 36th chapter of the book of Yechezkel. V'atem Hare Yisrael, you the mountains of Israel, An Pechem Titenu, Ufer Yechem Tisu La'ami Yisrael Ki Kervu Lavo. You, the mountains of Israel, will produce your branches, and you will bear your fruit for my people Israel, because they are about to come. Ki hineni aleichem, ufaniti aleichem, v'ne'evadetem v'nizratem. Here it is. I am for you. I will turn to you. You'll be tilled. You'll be sown, etc. I'll multiply men upon you in the land of Israel, the whole house of Israel in its entirety, and the cities will be settled, the ruins will all be built up. I will multiply upon you man and beast. They'll be fruitful and multiply, and I'll settle you as in your early days. I'll make you better than your beginnings. You will know that I am the Lord, and I will cause man to walk upon you, my people Israel, and they will inherit you, and you will be to them for an inheritance, and you will no longer continue to be bereaved of them. And Rabbi Abba says that's how you know Mashiach is coming. That's where you can hear his footsteps coming. And that's what happened. And that then led to the next question. Okay, so we can hear his footsteps. He's coming. Ikvatat Mashiach. What do we do in the interim period? How do we help bring him faster? What's going to happen? The son of Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, adopted a policy, an ideal, which seized hold of the entirety of the religious Zionist movement, barring a minority or a silent majority. I shouldn't actually say for sure. I don't really know. I don't think anybody knows. But certainly became the most vocal element of religious Zionism that was reading the Ramban's Hasagot on the Rambam. The Rambam codifies 613 mitzvahs, 248 positive mitzvahs, 365 prohibitions. He left out a small mitzvah called living in Israel. And no one can figure it out. How can he leave it out? The Ramban says, I don't understand. He left out a mitzvah asay. Maybe, how about living in Israel? How about the whole Torah is about that? How about, right? So, for the Rambam, the various defenders of the Rambam explain. He didn't mention it as a mitzvah, because all the mitzvah tluyot ba'aretz, that's what it means. The Ramban had a particular idea about it. Mitzvah revi'ich nistavinu la'reshet ha'aretz. It's not just to live in the land, it's to actually inherit the land, which doesn't mean just to take title deeds, but it means to settle and grow the place, and to own the place, and to have sovereignty over the place. And that's the nature of the mitzvah. Ashenatana kel yid barach mitalel avotim la'avram liyitzchak liyakov. I have to translate that. God gave it to, and fill in the blank. V'lo nezva b'yad zulatenu mina umot ol ishmama. We will not let it alone for anyone else from the nations, and we will not let it remain desolate. V'hu amarolahem, etc. V'rashtem et ha'aretz v'yishavtem ba. It's a mitzvah de'oraita from Parshat Maaseh. This is how it is. This idea, therefore, the land of Israel, living in the land, conquering, holding the terra firma of the land, equals religious Zionism, became a much more prevalent idea. Says Rav Amital, you know, in 1948, we didn't have Gush Katif. We didn't have part of Yerushalayim. We were dancing and celebrating in the streets. He said, I myself, he said, said a Shechianu Bracha B'Shem Umalchut in 1947 when I heard about a partition plan. And I was saying Reshit Smichat Gulatenu all those years before Yerushalayim and Yehuda and Shomron and Aza. And that's what it meant to me. And he spoke also 2005 before Yom HaAtzmaut. It's hard to take ourselves back there, right? It's years and years ago. But people were really concerned, not just for what was going to happen with the disengagement, but what was going to happen to the fabric of the whole Jewish community, the religious Zionist community. He himself says, I feel that while it is true that intellectually we should be celebrating Yom HaAtzmaut, he spoke in the yeshiva that year. He said, it's psychologically and emotionally difficult for me to rejoice. One reason for this difficulty concerns upcoming events in Gush Katif. One of the 48 traits by virtue of which the Torah is acquired is sharing the yoke with one's neighbor. In other words, you must not let another person bear his burden alone. You have to stand by and observe from the side. Rather, one must feel existential partnership with his brother in distress and help share his burden. Along with his anxiety for the residents of Gush Katif, he said he had grave concerns about the security of Israel after this engagement. What was going to be? Right? And he was concerned. Everyone was concerned. He said he felt, though, that, quote, we are all part of religious Zionism, a movement that is currently in deep crisis. What was the crisis? He goes on to describe what I'm explaining this evening. This crisis of deep certitude that the only thing that can happen is one thing, a path forward to greater and greater conquest, ownership of the actual terra firma of the land of Israel. We weren't rejoicing in 1948, says Rav Amital, because of what Ramban taught, but rather because of the fulfillment of Herzl's vision. This might sound like a striking idea, yeah? And it's not that Rav Amital doesn't believe that Mashiach Tzidkenu will come, so what we'll get, we're going to get. It's that there's a question here about what are one's religious priorities and how does it stack up in the relationship to, as the doctrine became known, Eretz Yisrael HaShlema. If we have vested our ideals of religious Zionism, which are so much about Am Yisrael and Torah Yisrael, if we have collapsed all of them into the investment into the Eretz Yisrael component, what happens when there is, perhaps in our rose garden, a place of uprooting? If everything is just about what happens literally to the soil, then we have not left any room for what happens the day after. And we start falling into tropes about God will never let it happen. Heichal Hashem, Heichal Hashem, Heichal Hashem Hema. And we start losing a sense of humility and garnering more of a sense, unfortunately, of the most dangerous type of hubris, spiritual hubris. It's not just that God is with us, come what may. Is that God is with us, and therefore we can never lose. We can never take a step back. That is a grave danger. That danger is not on display just in the 20th and 21st centuries. That danger was on display through much of the First Temple period. It's on display in Sefer Melachim, Aleph, and particularly Melachim Bet. And that's something that I feel is just so critical. And Rav Amital speaks about this idea, about recognizing this factor, and being actually careful to be mindful of it. He actually quoted Rav Gorin, of all people, Rav Gorin, who, as you know, was known to be most resolute in his ideas. Rav Gorin, apparently, right after the Six-Day War, announced, you know, in Parshat Beshalach, it says, God took the Jewish people around, v'lanacham elokim derech eretz plishim ki karovu, right? He didn't want to take them near the plishim because he didn't want them to have to fight in a war. Says Rav Gorin, why didn't God just make a bunch of miracles like he did in Eretz Mitzrayim? Answer, Could God then not perform miracles for Egypt in the war to conquer the land? For Israel, excuse me, in the war to conquer the land, as he did for them in Egypt? What Rav Gorin said is that this was proof that wars of conquest of Eretz Yisrael are not carried out through miracles, but rather through human means. And this is a crucial component. And it's critical for us, beyond Yamit, beyond Gush Katif, to ask ourselves, what kind of a rose garden do we think we're in? Or related to when we speak about Medinat Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. Much more obviously to be said on the subject. I'll just share with you the vignette that I spoke about a few years ago that I always think about. A friend of mine made Aliyah. He went to the Misrat HaPinim in Israel. And he was just being given absolutely the runaround. His brother had already made Aliyah. He had family living everywhere. And they just were not letting him alone. Everything fell out of form. Wrong form. He come to the wicket. Closed. He got another form. Oh, you come back tomorrow. He couldn't get over it. So he's finally waiting in a waiting room. There's no air conditioning. It's sweltering hot. And he says to me, I look up at the wall, and there is a poster. And the poster is of some kind of a little bramble. And it says underneath it, Right? Whoever promised you a rose garden? He said, when he saw that, you know, the expression, Nafala Asimon, realized, okay, maybe. Maybe I have to just take myself in hand and to think a little bit about this idea. Again, none of this removes the human element of pain, but I'm trying to tease out a few lessons of some hopefulness or some, at least some coping mechanisms to think about these categories, about these ideas. The greatest hitnatkut withdrawal that ever took place in Jewish history, for sure, bar none, by a Jewish leader, by a Jewish leader's own hand, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Tein li yavna v'chachameha. Everyone lauds it as the great saving of the Jewish people, that he felt Yerushalayim was not going to be saved. He stood before Vespasian and the like. Rabbi Avraham Wolfish, who himself was a Talmud of Rav Soloveitchik, Talmud of Rav Lichtenstein, teaches in Machon Herzog, various other places, actually says that if you look carefully, there's something that happens in the deathbed of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai that is very telling in retrospect about what happened in that encounter with Vespasian. You see, when he encountered Vespasian, you recall that it almost sounded like Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had some kind of prophecy. He actually says to Vespasian, the Gemara in Gittin, you're soon going to be in charge. Vespasian says, oh, yeah, can it be? Yeah, it's going to be. You know, Vespasian's very impressed and the like. Rav Wolfish points out that in the Gemara in Brachot, it says that they come to visit Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, the Talmidim come in to see him, he's on his deathbed. This is the great leader of the Jewish people, right? This is he's the one who enacted more Zecher LeMikdash than anybody else in Halacha, yeah? That we're going to do this or that as a memorial to the Mikdash. He knew all about memory. He knew all about what it meant to be a Jewish leader. So they come in to see him, and when he sees his students, he starts crying. Amru Tamida, they said to him, Ner Yisrael, Amura Yemini, Patisha Chazak, Mipnei Ma Tabuche, you're the light of Israel, you're the right pillar, you are the strong hammer, why are you crying? What did he say? If they were taking me in front of a corporeal king of flesh and blood, who's here today and tomorrow dies, who gets angry today, tomorrow, it won't necessarily last. If he imprisons me, it won't be forever. If he kills me, it won't even be forever. Right? And maybe I could even assuage him, lefaisa bedvarim, I can sweet talk my way out of it. I can convince him somehow. Maybe I can bribe him somehow. I'd still be crying. So now that they're taking me, and he goes through the whole thing again. Now they're taking me before the King of Kings, who if he gets angry, it's forever. If he imprisons me, forever. If he kills me, it's forever, etc. And I am not able to talk my way out of it. I can't fool him. I can't get away from him. I can't bribe him. Not only that, but I see in front of me, says Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, it's cryptic, two paths, achat shel gan eden, v'achat shel gehenem, and I don't know which one they're taking me to. V'eini yodeya be'ezom alechim oti, v'lo efke, I shouldn't cry? Hold on. This is Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Humility is, of course, the trait of all of our sages, all of our great leaders. They don't operate with hubris, but humility and a lack of self-awareness are two very different things. Rabbi Avraham Wolfish points out that then the students say to him, well, give us a bracha. He gives them a bracha. They go back and forth. He says that the fear of heaven upon you should be like the fear that you have for flesh and blood. So the students say, is that it? And he says, yeah. Halavai, you should fulfill that. You should know what a person does in Avera. They're thinking, let a person not see me. Bishat p'tirato. And here's the punchline cryptic part. Amar bishat p'tirato. He's going to die. Milam, what does he say to them? Pnu keilim ipnei atuma. Take out the vessels that are open because they're going to become ritually impure. Vehachinu kisei lechizkiyahu melech Yehuda sheba. Prepare a chair, a throne for King Chizkiyahu who is going to arrive. Is this the last moment of sort of going into the fog of illness and not being able to express himself? If that was the case, would Chazal record it? Says Rabbi Avraham Wolfish, in the lifetime of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he did stand before a corporeal king. He did sweet talk his way out. He was given an option to ask for certain things. And he made a choice to ask for one thing and not the other. He asked for the sages and not for Yerushalayim. That's a haunting element of his life. Says Rabbi Wolfish, you know why he's asking for the Kisei of Chizkiyahu HaMelech? Because it was a moment in Chizkiyahu HaMelech's life where the soldiers from Ashur had arrived at the gates of Jerusalem. And Chizkiyahu had to decide, do I open the gates and give them some kind of capitulation to Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, knowing that 10 tribes are no more and we're all that's left. We are the sukkah in the Kerem. Or do I stand tall and stay with God and say, it'll be okay, and we're going to fight to the last man? And Chizkiyahu fought to the end. Says Rabbi, and what happened? He was saved. Says Rabbi Avram Wallfish, does my behavior on this previous occasion, asks Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, he's asking himself, merit Gan Eden or Gehenna? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, agonizing over the rectitude of his surrender of Jerusalem, recalls a leader of Israel who, against all political and military logic, stood fast against the Assyrian juggernaut and saved Jerusalem from destruction. Chizkiyahu was blessed with the counsel of a prophet, whereas Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had nothing to follow but his own human wisdom, guided by interpretation of scripture. Imagining Chizkiyahu coming to greet him in the next world and to conduct him before the heavenly king, he foresees two possible scenarios. Chizkiyahu might greet him sadly, questioning why Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai did not follow his own prophetically guided precedent, or he might lay a gentle hand on his shoulder and console him by noting the differences between the two seemingly analogous historical events. And that's a critical element, I believe, of this story of being beyond Yamit and Gush Katif. Not getting into the politics of it, but on the level of how we understand what occurred, what right we have or don't have to ascribe religious meaning, and how we will do that, and what motivations to the Almighty we will attach or attribute, needs to have a really serious element of humility that characterizes it. Beyond Gush Katif, beyond Yamit and Gush Katif, whoever promised you a rose garden? I chose the title for a particular reason. Near Arlington House in Washington, just there in Virginia, was once part of its famous Rose Garden, stands a monument. It's now the Arlington National Cemetery, of course, but there's a monument in its famous Rose Garden. And that monument is dedicated to the unknown soldiers who died in the Civil War. The monument was dedicated in September of 1866 and stands atop a masonry vault containing the remains of 2,111 soldiers gathered from the fields of Bull Run, etc. And the remains were found scattered across the battlefields or in trenches and brought here. This monument was the first memorial at Arlington to be dedicated to soldiers who had died in battle and who later could not be identified, because in some instances, only a few bones or a skull were recovered. It is assumed that the vault contains the remains of Confederate soldiers as well as Union troops. In the end, they're in the same cavern, the Rose Garden. I'm also thinking, and since I agreed to give this talk, there was one historical development with the passing of Yehuda Avner, but I ceaselessly think of Prime Minister Menachem Begin, Zichrono Livracha, and what occurred at the Hakamat HaMedina, which was close to a civil war. It was madness, says a younger Menachem Begin in Tveria, speaking to a group of people in an old burned out cinema of some sort. And that was the first time Yehuda Avner went to go hear him in person. It was madness. It was tearing Jews apart. I could smell the stench of civil war. So I told our men of the Irgun to go quietly, not to resist. It was extremely hard to order our men to restrain the natural instinct for revenge, but I had to do it. I had to do it, ki Yehudim anachnu, because we are Jews. And so on and so forth. He said, oh yes, it was very hard. Our fighters understood my command. They humbled their natural instinct for reprisal. They surrendered quietly, many of them to be transported to British detention camps in Eritrea. This roundup was given a name. It was given the name of a hunt. They called it the open season, and we were the fair game. And not one of them, he says further along, not one of them broke his solemn oath to retaliate. From the depth of Jewish history came the order not to fight back, and it was obeyed to the very last man. Now hear this, each and every one of you, and hear it well. I live by an iron rule. A Jew must never lift a finger against a fellow Jew. Never. A Jew must never shed the blood of another Jew. Never. 20 centuries ago, we faced the bitter experience of destruction of our second temple, destruction of our capital, Jerusalem. And why? Because of our senseless hatred of each other, a hatred that led to the civil war and to our utter ruin. Bichiyah ledorot, generations of tears. And therefore, I long ago took a solemn oath, no matter the provocation, no matter the circumstances, I would never be a party to a civil war. Never. And he goes on in this very, very powerful address to talk about the idea that he never cried because of any battle or any loss. But the night of the Altalena, he wept bitter tears. And to this day, he said, there are enemies who mock me because of those tears that I shed in public and that night in my radio address, and let them jeer. I feel no shame. These are tears. There are tears of which no man need be ashamed. On the contrary, these are the tears of which a man can be proud. Tears know not only come from the eyes. Sometimes they well up like blood from the heart. Whoever has followed my story knows that fate has not pampered me. He goes on to describe what has occurred. How death has brooded over him. They said he wept that night because of the Altalena. Why? He wept because there are fateful times when a choice has to be made between blood and tears. During our revolt against the British, blood had to take the place of tears. But at the time of the Altalena, Jew against Jew, tears had to take the place of blood. Far better for one Jew to shed tears from his heart than to cause many Jews to weep over graves. This is a great instructive example of a certain historical perspective of how closely the Jewish people teetered on the brink at the time of Hakamata Medina. And I think, again, what occurred in 1982, but particularly in 2005, was also dancing on the edge of an abyss. Thank God nobody stepped into it. And we can feel a certain sense, I think, of hopefulness in that self-discipline, and in that overriding, so far, thank God, overriding idea of not lifting up a hand, one Jew against the other. I want to close with a story. It's also a Ramital story. It's actually one of my favorites. They said students would ask him all the time whether he thinks that the state of Israel is Reshit Tzemichat Geulatenu, whether it's really the first flowering of our redemption. Those flowers to me, by the way, in case it wasn't already apparent, are of course roses in my analogy here. But they would ask him all the time. So he said, let me tell you a story to tell you what I think about Reshit Tzemichat Geulatenu. He said that there's a story told about Reb Levi Yitzchak Berditchever that one year on Yom Kippur, he was at Ne'ilah, and he came to the bracha in Ne'ilah, the last bracha before Ritzeh, to the words, Melech Soleach. Melech, Mochel, Soleach, etc. King who pardons the iniquities of his people and the like. And he was silent for several moments. And everybody in the shul was waiting with barely controlled tension. Then Reb Levi Yitzchak suddenly was quiet. And suddenly he burst forth. Finish. So later, they came over to him and they said to him, Rebbe, were you going to pass out? What happened? Why did you stop in the middle? He said, I'll tell you. I realize in the middle, while I'm davening the Ne'ilah, there's a terrible decree against the Jewish people. And I realized that this decree is going to prevent Kapara from coming to Klal Yisrael this year. And I couldn't finish the bracha. But when I paused, I remembered a story from my youth. Reb Levi Yitzchak said, when I was a little boy, we had a game we used to play in the house. We wanted a particular food, and we knew my mother wasn't going to let us eat the food. And there was something good to eat in the house. What would we do as children? We'd run up to the food, lay a hand on it, and quickly, very loud, say the bracha, shachar l'midvar. What could our mother do? We had to eat the food. That's how we got to eat it. This forced her to give us what we wanted, because otherwise it would be a bracha levatala, superfluous bracha. So I did the same thing in my prayers. When I saw that all hope was lost, said Reb Levi Yitzchak, I loudly made the bracha. I paused and I shot through it. The king who pardons our iniquities of his people Israel. I didn't give God a choice. Now he has to forgive us, because otherwise it would be a bracha levatala. Said Rav Amital to the students, so too when I say the words, Reshit Tzemichat Geulatenu. If we will recite this phrase with special kavana, special concentration, our tefillot, then it will indeed come true. Adkan.